So, we've been going through this book, Don't Believe Everything You Think, which is a commentary on a Tibetan poem written several centuries ago. And it deals with real life situations that we all experience, that we all find difficult, and gives us advice on how to work with these situations. Of course, the advice is usually the opposite of what our present mental state wants to do, which is why it's the antidote. Yeah. If the advice went along with our present mental state of anger or dissatisfaction or whatever, then it certainly wouldn't be the antidote, would it? It would just increase our mental afflictions. Okay, so we've gone through some of the verses so far. If you are interested in them, they're on the website, on the Srivasti Abbey YouTube channel, right? Huh? Yeah. So you can go and listen to them there. Today we're doing verse 13, which is about transforming suffering. Okay? So even if someone tries to cut off your head when you haven't done the slightest thing wrong, out of compassion, take all her misdeeds upon yourself. This is the practice of bodhisattvas. Okay, so bodhisattva is somebody with great compassion who aspires for full awakening for the benefit of all living beings. Okay, so the situation is, even if somebody tries to cut off your head, which that's pretty extreme, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, it happens in some places in the world, but usually, you know, that's not what we face, okay? But he's saying even in that horrendous, dire situation where somebody tries to cut off your head, and when you haven't done the slightest thing wrong, okay? So it's not like, you know, you were a criminal and botched things up and harmed many living beings and you're getting your retribution by the justice system. Is, you know, you haven't done anything wrong. And, you know, somebody's totally lambasting you, harming you in various ways, you know, up to the point of cutting off your head. But meanwhile, you know, you haven't done anything to warrant that kind of treatment. Mm-hmm. Now, clearly, sometimes when, when people mistreat us, most of the time actually, when people treat us poorly, we feel like we're innocent victims of their bad moods and their anger and stuff like that, don't we? Yeah, it's never our fault. Yeah? It's never our fault. I had a friend who did conflict resolution training and mediation, and he said, I went to one of his workshops and he commented how it's always the nice cooperative people who come to his workshops, never the people who are uncooperative. So I have the same thing. I always have the sweet, innocent people who never do anything to irritate anybody else come to the Dharma talks, right? Aren't we all sweet, innocent, benevolent, kind? We would never do anything. We do something to set other people off, but not deliberately, just accidentally. Or as my mother used to say, accidentally, deliberately. You know, like, you know somebody else's buttons? Yeah? Then you just so sweetly, innocently, you know? And then when they get ticked off, you look around like, oh, why are you irritated? I didn't do anything. You're just too sensitive. Yeah, it's never our fault. Really amazing, huh? Yeah, so once in a while, yeah, we might you know, lose our temper just once in a while, right? Yeah. And say something rather nasty and mean to other people. But it's only because they really deserved it and we're doing it for their own good. But they do get irritated. Yeah. or sometimes actually enraged by what we've done. Yeah. So sometimes the situation's like that, and sometimes it is truly that we haven't done anything wrong, or something. Sometimes it's we've done something wrong in somebody else's perspective, but when we look at our motivation, we were acting, you know, with a kind thought, you know, with a positive motivation. And yet still other people are unhappy with what we do and attack us. I had that happen a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, people think nobody does mean things to nuns. Let me tell you. You want to hear my problem? Oh, yeah. You have a few hours? Oh, yes, I'll tell you my problem. It's the most important thing that happened in the world this last week. Yeah, I got blamed for something that I didn't do. And something I did do with a kind motivation, they didn't like. The nerve. Okay. So, even if someone tries to cut off your head, we don't usually get retaliation like that. When you haven't done the slightest thing wrong, sometimes we might have done the slightest thing wrong, but just the slightest thing. Then, what's the antidote, you know? Yeah. Well, first of all, how do we feel when we're blamed for things? Yeah, we usually get pretty angry, don't we? Especially if we feel that it was undeserved, you know? At least if you're going to blame me, I should have gotten the satisfaction of harming you first. This is the way our crazy mind thinks, as if harming others is going to bring us great satisfaction. Yeah, well, it doesn't. Yeah. But anyway, you know, when we're harmed, kind of something's going on there. We, in one way or another, triggered somebody's buttons, either deliberately, accidentally, or, you know, whatever it was. Yeah, but we usually, instantly, our defenses come up, right? Yeah, instantly. Yeah, and so we're angry, most of us, right? We feel that we've been unfairly accused. Yeah. And we want to explain ourselves. So this is what I mean by our defenses come up. Then we want the person, we have to tell the person the long story of da 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 why we did something. Okay? They don't really want to hear that story. Yeah, they aren't usually very interested in it. But we feel the need to tell the story about why we did the way what we did. Sometimes, you know, it is helpful to somebody, you know, and it does calm them down. But usually, before they can hear our story of why we did what we did, we have to empathize with them in some way or another and let them know that, you know, we're concerned about their being hurt or angry or whatever it is. Okay? It's usually only then that people can listen to something else that's outside of what they're thinking. Okay. So, you know, first thing is to kind of, you know, listen to the person and respond instead of with defense, with some kind of empathy. Empathy does not mean that we take responsibility for their feelings and that we blame ourselves, you know, for something that is a misunderstanding or whatever. It simply is showing that we care about what the other person is experiencing. That's all. That we acknowledge their feelings, that we care about it. We're not saying that we're the source of their feelings. Okay? Because everybody, you know, we're all the source of our own feelings. Yeah. You know, when I get angry, it isn't that you made me angry. I have anger inside. My anger came So, we listen with some empathy, we try and understand, and then, out of compassion, take all her misdeeds upon yourself. At this point, our self-centered mind says, you're crazy. Yeah? Somebody is cutting off my head or doing something very drastic, you know, that really interferes with my happiness and my interests when I haven't done anything wrong. And then I'm supposed to take all of their misdeeds upon myself? That's not right. That's not fair. They should take all of my misdeeds and suffering upon themselves. Because after all, I'm sweet and innocent and kind and benevolent. Okay? So what this is referring to when it says, you know, to take all their misdeeds upon ourselves, is referring to a meditation that we call the taking and giving meditation. Okay? And this meditation is done to increase our feelings of love and compassion for others. So, you know, love in Buddhism is defined as the wish for somebody to have happiness and the causes of happiness. And compassion is the wish for them to be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. That's all. Okay? So, you know, in our meditation, we're trying to increase our feelings of love and compassion. And we do this through this taking and giving meditation. And prior to the meditation, yeah, we've done a lot of reflection about the kindness that other living beings have shown us, our dependence on them, how they have benefited us so much, not only the people we know, but also strangers, and also even people who have harmed us. If we look at it in a certain way, we see that they've benefited us. And we've also done a lot of meditation reflecting on the misery that other sentient beings, other living beings go through, you know. Physical misery, mental misery, just the whole situation of cyclic existence. And so we've spent some time reflecting on this and generating a feeling that wants them to have happiness and to be free of suffering, because we realize that they're just like us. That our happiness is not more important than theirs, that our suffering doesn't hurt more than theirs, that we all equally are worthy and deserving of happiness and not misery. Okay, so we've done a lot of reflection on that. And then, when our love and compassion are strong, to increase them, we do the taking and giving meditation. Okay, so usually in life, when there's suffering, when there's a problem, we're very happy to give that to other people. Yeah? When there's difficulty at work, you can fix it. Yeah? When there's something inconvenient to do, you can figure it out. Right? Yeah? Whenever possible, we wiggle out of doing what we don't want to do and give it to other people to do. Meanwhile, yeah, whenever there's any happiness to be gained, you know, whenever there's praise or reputation or material benefit or status of some kind, anything to be gained, we will very happily take that ourselves. Okay, this is how our self-centered attitude works, isn't it? You know, there's a problem, something bad, you can have it. If there's something good, I'll take it. Okay? That's the self-centered attitude. This self-centered attitude is actually the cause of so much of our pain and misery in life, because it makes us super sensitive so that we take offense when other people aren't doing anything. And it also makes us think we're the most important ones in the world, so we get all riled up when people don't treat us in the way we think we deserve to be treated. Because, after all, I am me. Yeah? And everybody should treat me well. Everybody should honor me, respect me, realize that everything I think is correct, even if I changed my mind from yesterday. You know, everybody should know that, you know, since I am always correct, then I should always win every fight, you know, and I should always have the last word in every discussion, because I'm always right. Yeah, so our self-centered thought that's just thinking about me and what I want, you know, this mind whose slogan is, I want what I want when I want it. Yeah, that mind actually creates a whole bunch of problems for us because, you know, when we're acting just from our own perspective and not considering the feelings of others and being demanding and selfish, then, you know, it sets other people off and it makes them unhappy, and understandably so, you know. And then, of course, when we've made other people unhappy, they, you know, let us know that they're unhappy in no uncertain terms, and then we have more problems, okay? So, you know, we've done some, prior to do the taking and giving meditation, we've really seen that the self-centeredness that, you know, is behind so much of our daily actions, actually that's what our enemy is. Yeah, this very impulsive, impetuous mind that just is trying to get everything good for myself and forget everybody else, basically. Of course, you know, we're very sophisticated people, aren't we? We're not two-year-olds. Two-year-olds are very honest. Give me this. No, I won't do that. We're adults. Yeah. We know how to put on a good face. Right? So that we convince people that doing what we want them to do is in their best interest. Yeah. We are so clever. So, but still it's the same self-centered mind, isn't it? And, you know, inside we throw tantrums when we don't get what we want, even though we don't show that on the outside. You know, of course, we behave very nicely on the outside until we make some nasty remarks about somebody behind their back. But, you know, when we really contemplate the effects of our self-centeredness, we see that it propels us to do a lot of things that are against our own ethical values and that cause problems in our relationships with other people. Yeah. And so we begin to see that the self-centered thought is really our biggest enemy, not other people. Yeah. Other people are kind. Everything we have is due to other people giving us stuff. Yeah. So it's the real problem is, you know, our distorted way of thinking. So when we have some confidence in that, and then we also think about the benefit of helping others, and the benefit not just of helping them, because we can't directly help everybody, but just the benefit of cherishing everybody. You know, somewhere in our heart, finding the huge, big room where we can really cherish other living beings, you know, simply for who they are, not because they do something nice to us or agree with us or whatever, but just because they are a living being, that's all. Yeah. And to cherish them for that reason and want to be a benefit to them for that reason. Yeah. Because we're all exactly alike. I know this is the total opposite of what, you know, our country's media is teaching us nowadays. And it's the opposite of the examples we're getting from people in government and people in big industries and corporations and Wall Street, where it seems like everybody's out for themselves. But hey, I don't mind being different than those people. Yeah? I don't want to be like them. So having good, different values is a good way to start. You know, so we really have reflected on the disadvantages of self-centeredness, the benefits of cherishing others. Yeah? And then when those feelings get very strong, then we do the taking and giving meditation, in which we imagine, we start out maybe with a small group of people who have a specific kind of misery or suffering. And we think with a mind of compassion, may they be free of that suffering. And we meditate so that our compassion becomes so strong that we feel, I want to take their suffering away from them so that they can be free from it. And I'm willing to bear their suffering for them. Okay? And so at that point in the meditation, we visualize people, in front of us who have a particular kind of misery. We imagine that suffering kind of coming out of them in the form of pollution or some kind of disgusting substance. And it comes out of them so that they are then free of their suffering. And we imagine taking this pollution, which is their suffering, upon ourselves, because our compassion is so strong that we're willing to bear it for them. But we don't just take somebody else's suffering and then sit there like, ourselves, because that doesn't do any good. What we think is that our own self-centeredness, which is this lump, hard lump at the center of our chest. You know how when you feel really certain emotions, it's like there's a lump here. Yeah. And we imagine that lump is our own self-centered mind, and that we're taking the suffering of others upon ourselves with happiness. And as we inhale their suffering in the form of pollution, it transforms into like a lightning bolt or something like that, that then strikes at this lump of self-centeredness in our own heart. And that lump of our own misery that's caused by our own selfishness completely vanishes. It's demolished. This lightning bolt, it's gone. And so what we've done is we've taken what other people don't want, which is their misery, and used it to destroy what we don't want, which is our own self-centeredness. Okay? And then in our heart, once that horrible, heavy lump of self-centeredness is gone, then there's just a feeling of open space. When our self-centeredness is gone, I don't need to defend myself. I don't need to justify myself. I don't need to protect myself. It doesn't mean that I'm going to be vulnerable to anything, because it's the self-centeredness that makes me feel vulnerable. And once I get rid of the self-centeredness, the feelings of vulnerability go away. Okay? Because our self-centeredness is always, what about me? What if this happens? What if that happens? What am I going to do? Oh no. Where does worry and anxiety and fear, what's the root of worry, anxiety, and fear? What's going to happen to me? What are people going to do to me? How am I going to look to others? How am I going to appear? What's going to happen? How am I going to get a job? What happens if I lose my job? Oh, I've got to find a relationship. What happens if I don't find a relationship? What happens if my relationship breaks up? What happens if this happens? What happens if that happens? I don't know what to do. My life is everything so confusing. Who is the star of that anxiety, worry show? It's all about me, isn't it? Yeah? So once we put that self-centered mind down, we don't have to spend so much time
or money thinking about what's going to happen to me. Yeah? Because the thing is, the anxiety and worry and fear do not protect us. Yeah? Wisdom and compassion protect us from harm. Anxiety, worry, and fear don't protect us. They make us crazy, as we all know, because we suffer from them. Yeah? So if we drop the self-centeredness, we can drop the worry, anxiety, and fear. Then the feeling of vulnerability isn't there. And then we can just be with what is, with wisdom and compassion. You know? So it doesn't mean we become the world's doormat. It doesn't mean we let people do whatever they want. But we approach people, we approach the world with a feeling of kindness and compassion instead of a feeling of, you know, what are you going to do to me? Which, of course, our media likes to instill in us. So then there's this space in our heart. Yeah. Then, in that empty space in our heart, we generate a feeling of loving kindness for others, wanting them to have happiness in its causes. And then, again, in our imagination, we visualize taking our body, our possessions, and all of our spiritual merit, spiritual energy, multiplying it and transforming it into whatever anybody else needs and sending it out into the universe without any feelings of loss ourselves. Okay? So sometimes it's easier to start thinking of transforming our possessions and giving our possessions away. Yeah, when we do that, we usually start with something we have that we don't like, that we want to get rid of. You know, that's how our generosity starts. But gradually, you know, it can build up to even things we like and so on. So it's very nice, you know, think of the things that you have and think of people in the world who can use them, or even think of animals, you know, who can use different things. And then you imagine taking your possessions and they transform into whatever or whoever anybody else needs. And with a feeling of loving kindness, you send it out. So, you know, whoever needs a washing machine, you send them a washing machine. Whoever needs a new house, then you send them a house. Whoever needs this or that, you send them what they need, you know. You imagine also taking your body and multiplying it and transforming it and sending yourself out so that you become whoever anybody else needs. So somebody else needs a friend, you become their friend. Somebody needs a teacher, you become the teacher. Somebody needs a handyman around the house or a garbage collector, you become that. You know, you just do what you imagine. I mean, you imagine becoming what and doing whatever could benefit other living beings. And you do this with a feeling of love, with a joyful, happy mind. And then with our spiritual energy, our spiritual merit, that too, instead of saving it for ourselves, you know, we imagine giving that away and sending that out into the world. It becomes whatever others need so that they can meet, you know, whatever spiritual path is most suitable for them according to where they're at this particular moment. And we send it out so that they can have all the good conditions they need to be able to practice the path and develop ethical conduct and love and compassion and wisdom. Okay? And so we do all of this in our imagination, taking their suffering, destroying our own self-centeredness, giving them, you know, with a happy, joyful mind, our body, possessions, and merit. And then they receive all these things, and now they all become happy and satisfied, and they're able to practice the path, and at the end of the day, become fully awakened Buddhas. So we imagine that whole thing, and it's really nice. Yeah. And it's especially good you know, to do with the people who we don't like, you know, who are usually the ones that, you know, forget about taking on their suffering. We want to give them more suffering. But actually, when you think about it, the people who harm us, why are they harming us? Is it because they're happy? Yeah. They woke up that morning and they said, it's a beautiful day in Eastern Washington. I think I'm going to go make somebody miserable. Yeah, they don't think that. Why do people harm us? It's because they're unhappy. So especially those people, if we can imagine taking on the source of their unhappiness. Maybe it's their feelings of guilt and shame. Maybe it's financial problems. Maybe it's relationship problems. Maybe it's even a personality trait that makes it difficult for them to live happily with others. Whatever it is, we imagine taking it away from them, you know, with a feeling of compassion. And then it becomes something to destroy our own self-centeredness. And then, when that person is free from their suffering, they're not going to do what is so harmful to us or others anymore. Because once they are satisfied and happy, they don't have any reason to do anything damaging. Yeah. And so then we imagine giving them, you know, transforming our body possessions and merit and sending it out to them. And they receive it. You know, they're able to practice the spiritual path, gain the realizations, become fully awakened Buddhas. And isn't that wonderful? You know? So not just our friends and family, who it's easy to wish them well, but also the people that harm us, that we think are so obnoxious, to imagine them transforming. So that through our generosity, they are free of whatever pain or wrong views or afflictive emotions make them do what they do. Yeah. And then we start imagining, you know, that person as being happy and satisfied, because we, with our kindness and generosity, shared what we have with them. With a feeling of loving kindness. So this is, you know, a practice that we're being advised to do in this verse. It's not an easy practice. Yeah. Sometimes when we think of the taking and giving meditation, we get a little bit worried. Uh-oh. You know, somebody's suffering with cancer. If I imagine taking on their cancer, I might get it. First of all, you know, you're not going to get somebody else's cancer by doing this meditation. Yeah. Because we cannot take somebody else's karma. Yeah. We imagine taking it, but in actual fact, we can't. Yeah. So don't worry about getting sick. However, even if your mind says, oh, I might get sick, then you say, that's my self-centered thought again. I don't want to get sick. And then you say, my self-centered thought is my enemy. So it's okay if I get sick. Let my self-centered thought get sick. You give your misery to your self-centered thought because we are not our self-centered thought. We are not inherently selfish. Yeah, our selfishness is not the nature of our mind. It is not who we are. So in our minds, we separate it out. We let our self-centeredness, you know, have some problems. Because that's the real enemy. Okay, so that's what we're being told here. In each of these chapters, there's some stories that people have told me, real life stories about that illustrate the the verse. So there's the one in here is quite good. I thought I would read it to you. So this is the story. When he wrote it, he didn't know that I was doing a book and needed stories. He just wrote and told the story, and then I wrote and asked if I could put it in. Okay, so it's somebody, because we do prison work at the Abbey, so it's somebody who was incarcerated. And he told us, he said, "I'm incarcerated, and today was feeling rather strong aversion to a certain officer." He's being very polite. Okay. "We had a horrible storm. It was raining and the wind gusts were up to 50 miles per hour. I had to go outside to turn in my college books." These were in the good old days when they let inmates take college classes. Unfortunately, they've cut those, so many of those programs now. Anyway, he said, "I had to go outside to turn in my college books, which left me out in the rain at 8:45 in the morning. The next regular unlock, which is the time when we can move about and where I could go inside, wasn't until 10 o'clock, an hour and 15 minutes later. I asked the building control officer to let me in according to my dukat, which is a pass I had to turn in my books, okay, which should have let him in. He came to the window and he asked, what kind of dukat? And when I told him it was for turning in my books, he said, come back at 10 o'clock, which meant I would have to be out in the rain and wind for an hour plus. Over the course of an hour, many inmates went in and out with the officer. Clearly, he was letting in and out only those who he wanted to. At one point, he even let out and back in my cellmate. He made sure to only let him in, although he only had to press the same buttons to let us both in. So I stood out there, feeling the rain soak through my many layers of clothes. I tried to maintain peace of mind. I thought about all the animals who had no warm clothing, blankets, or cups of coffee. I felt the wind against my wet face, and I told myself it wasn't personal. The officer's response said more about the officer than about me, which is true. The experience was a reminder that at times I had refused somebody else's comfort. At 9:50, the power went out, and he had to let the 8 to 10 people who weren't worthy back in. That's how I felt, unworthy of a little compassion. Now at 4:50 in the afternoon, as my clothes are hanging on makeshift hooks and are still wet, I consider missing dinner to avoid wearing those wet clothes back into the rain. Truthfully, I'm still not feeling equanimity. But at the same time, I realize a few things. One, it isn't bringing me peace to hold on to my anger. Two, I'm pretty sure that officer isn't thinking about me out in the rain. And three, it does no good for anyone to fight dependent arising and emptiness. Okay? Does no good to fight the reality of a situation. While this letter hasn't been helpful in terms of explaining equanimity, it is helping me to see how hooked I am by this morning's events. Why do we hold on to our labels of friend, enemy, and stranger? Does holding on to the officer as an enemy perpetuate behavior on his part towards me? Does it predispose me to expect negative responses in the future? This touches on the need to go beyond hope and fear and to just let each moment be as it is. And yet, I suppose what I feel is attachment to a victim's stance. Poor me. But wait, I have the Buddha nature, So maybe what I really have is a mistaken identity. Then I realize it is all conceptual stuff that keeps me attached to the past. I breathe in, breathe out, and let it all go. Beautiful, isn't it? So, you know, we get stories like this from people who are incarcerated. It's quite amazing, really, how they practice. Okay, so we have a few minutes for questions or comments. This is your chance. Yeah?
How long can we let it go? I mean, it seems it can sometimes be very temporary, and that's the struggle. You know, it's like, oh, I let it go, and then there's relief. And
then it comes back again.
Then it comes back again.
You let it go. Oh, I'm done with that. And then next week. Yeah, this happens because we have a lot of mental habituation with a certain thought patterns and certain emotions. So it's going to take positive habituation, or I should say habituation with more constructive ideas and emotions. Yeah? Because we're very much creatures of habit, so we have to establish a new mental emotional habit. So this is why they call it practice. We have to practice transforming our mind. We have to do it again and again and again and again. And at first it may feel very unnatural. Like, I'm so angry, I just want to punch that person. Why do I have to think about, you know, any kind thought towards him? But as we, you know, begin to work with our own mind and see, as this inmate did, that holding on to anger only makes ourselves suffer. When we really get that from our own experience, yeah, then we can begin slowly to let some of this stuff go. And it may come back again, but then we have to remember again, oh, my anger makes me suffer. When I'm angry, the person I'm angry at is outdoing the living their life, they're okay. It's me that's miserable. So we keep reminding ourselves. Yeah? And then we think about how the other person wants happiness and doesn't want suffering, just like us. We keep coming back to that. I find it's also very helpful. Imagine the people that you're upset with, what they look like when they were babies. And see if you would be mad at them when they were a baby. I used to imagine George Bush as a baby very often. Yeah? Can you imagine him as a cute little baby? I know it's hard, but you know, he was. Yeah? No, it really helps, you know, because when people came into the world, you know, they're all. Everybody is a cute little baby. So. Yeah. Right, but we forget that, don't we? Other questions or comments? Yeah.
I'm a little confused. I understood the part about when you take something in, it's not happening to you, it's happening to this concept of the self-centered self. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the taking in, you said you're not taking in their karma.
Yeah, but you imagined, we cannot take somebody else's karma, but we can imagine taking their karma, we can imagine taking their suffering, because just imagining that helps us to increase our compassion.
So the purpose of taking it in is the increase of compassion.
Right.
But you're not really taking it.
Yeah. I mean, if somebody's sick, I can imagine taking their suffering. It doesn't mean that I can. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Because everybody experiences their own the results of their own actions. Nobody else can take that from us. But it helps us to imagine being able to take others' suffering from them, because that helps increase our compassion. And by increasing our compassion, then when we encounter a situation when we actually can be of help, we won't hesitate. The self-centered mind won't be there to say, well, no, don't do that for them, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Okay? Okay. Oh, yeah?
When you have, for example, a student-teacher relationship, or take a parent and a young adult, and young adults, maybe they want something, immediately, maybe to buy some new shoes or computer, they want money from their parents, and they get really miserly and really angry. And you want, as a parent, that your child is happy, right? But you can't definitely fulfill this wish. So is there atonement also an opportunity? Because you actually don't want to give that, you have to make borders.
Okay. So this is a very good question. So as a parent, you know, you may have a child who's a young adult who wants something, and they're saying, I want this, get me this, get me that. And maybe you don't have the money to do it, or also you know that if you do it, it's just going to spoil the child, you know. So then how do you do the taking and giving meditation here? Do you imagine giving them everything they want? Yeah? And then actually go out and buy it for them as an act of generosity? No, because this is where you have to use wisdom with your compassion. Okay? If you have a child who's very demanding, it doesn't help them to always give them what they want, because then they don't know how to function in the world. Yeah, and they're going to grow up to be a miserable adult because they can't deal with the frustration of not getting what they want. So your job as a parent, or your job of kindness to your parent, is to be honest and to say, no, you can't have that. And to model how to deal with the frustration of not getting what you want. Because kids learn by observing their parents. So how do you as a parent act when you don't get what you want? Do you complain? Do you get angry? Do you badger? Do you yell and scream? Yeah? Because if so, that's what you're teaching your kids to do when they don't get what they want. Do you nag? Yeah. Okay. So, you know, you need to teach the child how to deal with the that frustration. And sometimes talking with them. I mean, of course, if it's an older, like you said, a young adult or a late teen or whatever, you can talk to them and discuss the feelings and, you know, how to work with those feelings. Okay? But being kind doesn't mean you go out and get them what they want. So when you're doing the taking and giving meditation, what you would imagine is taking away their self-centeredness. Yeah, because it's their self-centeredness, their greed, their attachment that is making them whine and, you know, be so dissatisfied. So you imagine taking away that mental state that is plaguing them, that's causing those emotions and behavior. And you take that upon yourself. Yeah. And then you can still imagine giving them what they want, but you also imagine giving them the qualities that are going to help them to be satisfied in life, you know. Imagine giving them self-confidence and a sense of eternal peace and a sense of contentment and satisfaction. Okay. So, we'll dedicate merit.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and world. May the Lord have no decline, but increase for us.